The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Well, you're as likely to hear that in a taxi in Budapest, which I did, or in on a jukebox on the Bronx, because it is the unmistakable sound of Riverdance. I have a book in front of me, and it's called The Road to Riverdance, and its author is sitting with me as well, a man I've known for all my working life, basically, Bill Whelan. Good morning and welcome.
Morning, Pat.
I was wondering about this book, because it does start in Barrington Street. Are we in for Angela's Ashes?
No, we're not, but we're very close to it. I mean, Barrington Street was literally the next street up from Little Barrington Street, which is where Frank and Malachy lived with their uncle Ab Sheehan, who was Angela's brother.
Yeah. Now, did it rain as much on your street
always,
as it did
yeah.
on their street?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I think the rain was a little bit of an overinvention on the part of the movie, but we do have a fair share of it, you know, as you know.
Yeah. Now your childhood, growing up. I mean, there was music in the house. Did you really have an organ in the music room?
Yeah, we did. My father bought a Wurlitzer organ, which he loved to play himself. But I mean, my father wasn't really a keyboard player. He played harmonica. My mother was the keyboard player in the family. She was a really good classical pianist. But we had the organ there. And sometimes, you know, if we had a few friends over, my mother and I would play duets and that kind of stuff. So I did. I grew up listening to a lot of music, and a lot of it was, apart from my mother's performance, my father's massive interest in music, you know.
What was he listening to? And if you were to catch him singing in the bathroom, what would he sing?
Well, normally you'd find him singing kind of Irish camellias, but he had a big interest in opera, big interest in jazz, big interest in anything that was new. He was, you know, even though he was born in 1901, he was a very, very early adopter of kind of technology, loved cameras, loved, you know, everything to do with, you know, communications. He was, he loved it.
Reading the book in the early chapters, talking about a Bell and Howell projector.
Yes.
In your house. Because I remember as children, we used to rent movies at Christmas time. We had a kind of built a proscenium arch and all that to show our movies.
You're kidding.
So well, it's, you know, that was pre-TV.
We'd no nothing to be looking at on a Saturday night. My father used to rent them exactly like that from, I can't remember who the company was, but they sent the movies down on the train and we'd cycle up to the railway station in Limerick and pick up a pack of movies and look at them. Big 16 millimetre reels, you know. It was just like a little mini cinema. And he built, like in your home, the proscenium, he built a little projection room and put holes in the wall, much to my mother's absolute delight, as you can imagine. I grew up watching Laurel and Hardy and old westerns and stuff, you know.
Now you were made familiar by your father's influence with a lot of instruments, and you are a drummer manqué.
Yes. I don't say that too often in the presence of some drummers, but I did play. I played drums in bands in Limerick when I was, you know, in my teens. And I always had a big interest in rhythm.
rhythm was a rhythm, and sort of particularly sort of complex rhythms like you'd hear with any of the jazz stuff that my father had in the house. Dave Brubeck loved all that. So I had a big interest in drumming, and my father, there was a commercial traveller who used to come into the shop to my father, and he was an amateur drummer, but very good, and he used to bring in his sticks into the shop, and he taught me on the counter of the shop how to do paradiddles and a roll and stuff. So I ended up playing drums, but I also, I went to piano lessons, and for the amazing patience of my teachers, I also went to violin lessons. But that relationship ended early, for everybody's sake.
I mean, it is hard in the early stages to get anything remotely attractive out of a fiddle.
No, exactly.
And then you go to the west of Ireland or wherever, to Doolin, and you hear the master, the Frankie Gavins of the world, and
the Zoe Conways, it's amazing. And particularly in traditional music, the standard of playing has, over the last 30 years, it's extraordinary now, what young players are able to get up to.
Now, your journey took you through the Jesuits, and where your, I suppose, the kind of formality of your musical education was...
Well, not through them. All the formal music education I got was with... They didn't have a program in the school, like they do now in so many schools. They didn't have a program for music teaching. So any music we got came through doing things like school operas and stuff. But it was more the, private teachers who would either come to the house, or I would go to, people like Miss Dillon in O'Connell Avenue in Limerick, which I loved, and Charlie Sasha, who came into the house and taught me. So I had a lot of... And then the School of Music, of course, opened in Limerick in my teens. And in fact, I recently met my violin teacher, Eileen Hudson, and she's still amazingly still alive after all the damage I did to her over the years. But so the School of Music then was my next sort of music education.
Now, obviously, there were dance bands and so on, so there were people earning a professional living. Not a great living, but, there was a living to be made playing music. However, it would not have been what your mother and father would have wanted for you.
No. And in fact, they, even though they drenched me with music as I was growing up, they still didn't see it as a possible career. And I personally didn't want to do teaching. I could have gone on and done a BMUS, I guess. Yeah. But I didn't want to do music teaching. I wanted to do performance. And I, of course, like a lot of my contemporaries in the 60s, I was really attracted by what was going on in the worldwide music scene. Yeah. And I wanted to be part of that. I didn't want to be part of... just a kind of dry music school, if you like.
Yeah. And there was no UL at the time, so Dublin beckoned.
Yes, even though we marched on the street, I was reminded recently, and hired a train. A whole bunch of students in Limerick came to Dublin and actually marched on the Dáil and on the Department of Education for a university in Limerick. But there was no, as you say, there was no university in those days. So I came and I logged on for law in UCD in Earlsford Terrace.
Now, having gone through the book, there were many moments when the law would have stood you in good stead in terms of copyright and various other things that working producers, composers and all that have to go through. It's interesting, just to reflecting on Limerick, I mean, it did get its university and a very fine music department under the late Micheál Sullivan.
Absolutely. And it's a real matter of pride for all of us in Limerick that, that did happen eventually. But going back to the law, the law was helpful, even though I never practiced law. After I did my degree, I went straight back into music, which I never really kind of left. I was never going to leave it. And then I sort of began to get work in RTE when you were there, Pat. And, we did...
You were the MD on Kenny Live.
Yeah, exactly. And Saturday Live before that. And... RTE was an interesting, for me as a young guy coming into the music business, RTE gave me a lot of experience, because in those days RTE made a lot of kind of homemade programs, music programs. So, people who were not employed by the station but who were freelancers, we got a lot of experience and work out of that.
Now, there's so much in the book, and so many people that you worked with on film, like Van Morrison, Lamb was that film, wasn't it?
Yeah, with Liam Neeson.
And the description of working with Van... Not the easiest person to get on with, but in his own way, a genius.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, I tell the story in the book of how he played the music to me that he wanted as the theme music for the film. And it was totally appropriate. As soon as I heard it, I thought, oh, this is going to be wonderful on the film. But he, you know, Van always kind of, he worked on a slightly different roadway to a lot of the conventional music business and the film business. He didn't want to be involved in making a score for a film, but he was very, very keen to write something that would fit the pictures, and that was a very good experience.
Now, we're shortening everything, because let people read the book themselves, exactly, to be quite honest, exactly, to get the full story. But the building blocks for Riverdance were kind of incremental. Mm. I mean, there's a moment, is it in Seville? The chieftains are there. They've got a young svelte dancer called Jean Butler,
yeah, that's
dancing
right,
with them.
Yeah.
And then there the Spanish dancer who figured in Riverdance.
Yeah.
Yeah. So all the building blocks before Riverdance itself, the show happened, mm-hmm, but in the build-up to Riverdance, the halftime act at Eurovision, mm-hmm, It's extraordinary, because you can see all the constituent parts. The way you write it, we're all kind of almost gathering together like a cloud.
That's right. I mean, you know, a lot of people think that things happen, you know, as an explosive thing in a moment. And indeed, there were elements of that in Riverdance. It was an explosive moment for all of us. But actually, if you look back and you look to the Spirit of Mayo the previous year, there were the drummers in the Spirit of, yeah, Mayo, there was Anuna in the Spirit of Mayo, there was Michael Flatley and Jean Butler, and the previous year there was Maria Páchez in the Seville Suite. So all of these things were building up to a kind of an energy that ultimately suggested itself to all, yeah, of us into Riverdance.
But the interval act, yeah, I mean, the vision, it was Moya Doherty's vision that there should be something that would be better than a kind of a backdrop to people nipping out to make the tea before the voting.
Well, that's right. And a lot of people had to admit that they actually didn't go out for the tea. There was a little bit of a build-up for it in the week of Eurovision. But I think Moya's instinct was that we should do it live. Because normally, as you know, Pat, a lot of those inserts in the middle of Eurovision are done, they're pre-recorded and they're just played in on the night. And they're just allowed, yeah, to happen while everybody sort of gets ready for the voting.
I mean, by one, they had Hot as Flowers on the roof of the Berlaymont, which
that's
could not have been done,
yeah,
done live.
That's,
you know,
right. So that's normally how it was done. But Moya's instinct was that we should do this live. Now, that had a great effect because, the negative effect was everybody was completely insane with the nerves about it.
Yeah.
But equally, it created an enormous adrenaline. And when it happened on the night, the fact that it was live, the fact that there was so much at stake with all those dancers, with the singers, with the drummers, with everyone, Flatley and Butler, it was important that it was live. And that's what, yeah, gave it the energy.
But the worry even about the humidity in the place,
yeah,
and the sweat that might make the floor
and
slippy.
The floor, and, exactly,
and Michael Flatley, instead of being like a god, might have gone on this year.
Let's perish the thought. Yeah.
Yeah. But you describe, I mean, I was there, so I remember it so vividly. At the interval when it finally finished with that last drum beat, the place exploded.
It did. Everybody, except for the security men, write about this. It was extraordinary.
Yeah, impassively looking on.
Yeah, the security men just stared, kept looking around because, you know, as you know, Pat, you would remember, you know, the Israelis were involved and, the things were a little bit shaky in terms of security. And they just were totally impassive while around them, everybody was on their feet and waving all the international flags of Norway and, you know, Sweden and the UK. And then the great thing was that I had a single ready for release, and the next day it was on the radio.
And Wogan played it on the BBC.
And Wogan played it, and it went straight to number one. Which was incredible, bearing in mind that it was a 7-minute piece of music. And as you know, 7-minute piece of music on radio is a lot of airtime.
Hey Jude is about the equivalent.
Yeah,
you know,
and you don't hear it.
And even Bohemian Rhapsody is shorter than that.
Yeah, so. And MacArthur Park, if you remember Jimmy, yeah, Webb. But anyway, it was a very long piece, but it still made it. And it was number one for 18 weeks, which was extraordinary.
And it figured in the top 10 singles of the year.
Yeah. It did, yeah.
It's interesting looking at the front piece of the book where Ishka Baja. Yes. In other words, whiskey.
Yeah. Well,
or living water.
Yes. Yeah.
But basically, it wasn't called Riverdance. And you were the one who came up with the name.
Yeah.
And you own the name.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, Riverdance, I called it Ishka Baja all the time because that was my working title. And I considered actually having the lyric for the opening song with the Nuna in Irish. But then Ishka Baja is mentioned in the lyric. But eventually I thought the better of it. And I rang Moya one day and I said, Moya, I've had to think about the title. And she said, go on. I said, what would you think of Riverdance? And you can virtually hear her breathe a sigh of relief. Yeah. She was doing an international show here, and Ishka Baha was going to present all kinds of problems for broadcasters.
Yeah, all the commentators.
Yeah, exactly. So I changed it, and there's a picture there in the score in the book where I actually just crossed out Ishka Baha and put in Riverdance.
Now, Riverdance then became a show, and, you know, the road to that show is, you know, reasonably tortuous. It had to have investors, including Artie. There were some of the investors and Morris Cassidy. And but, you know, would it make a show? This was the question. Could it be expanded to command, say, the West End for a few weeks?
Yeah, and this was the challenge, Pat. More than anything else, it was how to turn 7 minutes into 2 hours. And my instinct all the time was, the other thing was that Moya felt that we should do, if we were going to do a full show, we should do it before the Eurovision came around again. So we had just a year.
Short window,
short window to get something going. So my instinct was, two, first of all, I felt that a whole evening of Irish dance mightn't sustain for 2 hours, particularly as Irish dance was at that time. Now, there have been changes in the 25 years since we started, but I didn't want it to be all Irish dance. But then what were we going to do? So I went back to the music that I had worked with over the years, to the Spanish, to the Eastern European, which I did with Andy Irvine and Davy Spillane, and to jazz, which was always a thing with me. And so we had the American jazz tappers, we had the Russian dancers, the Eastern European, and then we also had the Spanish. And they were all the elements that made the whole, if you like, the narrative that I wrote for Riverdance as a journey. Yeah. It was a journey.
It's interesting, you being, as I said earlier, a drummer monkey, the rhythms that you were using, 6-8 time, 4-4 time, that were not familiar to the Irish dancers. So,
well, not when put together. 6-8 is jig time and 4-4 is jig.
That's the point.
But the putting them together in the one bar.
And that would be the Balkan influence, would it?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, Balkan. And even going, in my own lifetime, going back to Dave Brubeck and, you know, all of Take 5, if you remember, that was in 5. Exactly. And I was always attracted by that. And the surprise of odd time signatures creates a tension. And then at the end of Riverdance, when we release into the full jig, it's like the tension is released. It's Anyway,
there's a lot of musicology in the book. We played a clip at the very beginning of the show as a trailer for you, Bill, of you saying none of us realized how it would transform our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And it has. I mean, totally.
Totally, it has. And we've had many marriages as a result of Riverdance. We've had hundreds of performers over the years. And now all these young musicians and young dancers who are now in the show, it's very gratifying to see. But it has been life changing. I mean, it was for me. And the reason I wrote the book up as far as that first night in London, the reason I wrote it up as far as there is because after that, and if I get a chance to write part two, after that is a completely different life. Yeah. After that is like,
I mean, it's a corporate life in a way, isn't it? You know, because it's a big company, touring companies. It's complex.
It's complex. And then as well as that, it is from the artistic perspective, it had moved me into meeting people that I really admired, like Carole King, becoming friendly with Jimmy Webb, and being able to do other music projects that I never would have been able to do pre-Riverdance.
Well, it's a terrific book. It's called The Road to Riverdance, written by Bill Whelan. It's published by the Lilliput Press. And Bill, it's a pleasure seeing you again.
Thank you very much for coming in and
talking to us.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.